Radio. I'm your host, James Gilliland, and we're broadcasting from the beautiful Trout Lake, Washington area, from the Self-Mastery Earth Institute, home of eSETI and internationally known UFO hotspot, and what some people call Paranormal Central. Just an amazing place here. We've got a great show tonight. My guest is Jim Berklin. He's a geologist extraordinaire, and without wasting any more time, I'd like to bring Jim on right away to get through some of the amazing information he's been bringing forward lately. Jim, are you with us?
Sure am. We got a pair of Jims here.
Yeah. Luckily, I got stuck with James at an early age, so that makes it a little easier.
Okay.
Yeah, I've followed your work in the past, and I think it's amazing how you've tied in all these different aspects together to look at geology and, you know, the earthquakes and what's been happening. A little more about that. I'd like to get your story about how you first got into this understanding of the predictions of these earthquakes and how that all tied in together.
Sure. I had 10 years of college and university training, a lot of experience with 11 years with the federal government, U.S. Coast and the U.S. Geological Survey and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. And all that time, I was always told that earthquakes were not predictable. They were random events. But since all these experts said so, I believed it. And I taught it when I taught the universities at Appalachian State University, North Carolina, and San Jose State University when I came back to California. So it was quite surprising when in late 73, in September, I became the first county geologist in Northern California, and I was greeted between September and December by six quakes in the San Francisco Bay Area, two of which I had felt myself. And all I had done was put them in my day book, taken calls from people if they'd felt them, and checked with the USGS and Cal Berkeley and Caltech or wherever to get more information on it, but not thinking at all that I would ever be trying to predict them. And then on January 8th of 1974, an article appeared in the newspapers, and most of the seacoasts around the nation, I do believe, and it was an item from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that said people along the seacoast might be especially alert to the possibility of coastal flooding due to an unusual astronomical alignment. So the tides would be extraordinarily high. And so I got out my almanac, and I have almanacs going back to the 1930s, and I found that on that very day, it was the first full moon of the year, and it was only an hour and a half away from the closest approach of the moon for the year. And it was only in the same week, just a week after, the closest approach of the Earth and the Sun. So we had syzygy, the lining up of the Sun, Moon, Earth, perigee, closest approach of the Moon, and perihelion, the closest approach of the Sun. And that's the main cause of our high tides, those three factors, not the stars and planets. Mm-hmm. So it occurred to me that if the ocean waters are being pulled out by this gravitational stress, that maybe the solid Earth is also kind of undulating, and that might trigger a fault line into action. Let's see, we've had six quakes. Let's see how they fit this wild idea. Well, look, day of the full moon, 2 days after new moon, day of perigee. All six of them fit within a seven-day period that at that time I called a seismic window.
Mm-hmm.
It's now become an eight-day window. And at that time, the only window referring to time was the moonshot window from NASA. We didn't have insurance windows and political windows and economic windows and all these other things, but there was a window of time when, in order to make a successful moonshot, we had to intercept the moon in its orbit and not try to catch it after it had gone by. So there were only about 3 days per month when the moon would be in a favorable position that we could catch it with our limited capability rockets. So it meant it was a period of time when something was likely to happen but didn't have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly my concept with seismic windows. So on that date, seeing those factors all coming together, I predicted to my fellow workers at Santa Clara County that we were likely to have a 4 to 5 magnitude quake within a week. And I also passed it along to a geologist with the state with whom I had with telephone contact about having future contracts with the state for their geologists to come down and map our county, and we would share the cost. And at that time, I mentioned about this syzygy perigee perihelion date and that we might have a quake, and he very quickly changed the subject. Now, it's quite clear, especially, well, we're back to that time again, where high science maintains earthquakes cannot be predicted, largely because they haven't been able to predict them. And whereas those of us that aren't restricted by high science philosophy say we are predicting quakes on a regular basis, that's about 75% accuracy, and we're not troubled because the leading scientists in this country are unable to predict them. In fact, we just got, I'm sure most people are aware now, we're, this next week is the 100th anniversary of the big one in San Francisco on April 18th. And I'm actually going to go down at 5:12 in the morning to Lotus Fountain and for the first time join some of the few survivors that are still around and join in the ceremony. And I'm going to be appearing in several radio stations and book signings and that sort of thing also.
It'll be great to get the story firsthand of what really happened versus the official story.
Quite so. And indeed, back in the early 80s and late 90s, I was 1979 and early 80s, I interviewed 5 survivors of that time. One was a 102-year-old man that was sharp as a tack. Mm-hmm. Who was 22 years old when the quake hit, and so he could really give me a picture of what happened. And they all agreed that thousands upon thousands of people had died in that earthquake and fire, and not the few hundred that the cover-up of data told us that it was actually had happened. See, history is his story,
exactly.
And he always seems to have an agenda. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out what it is.
Well, I know the tsunami quakes that they had, I guess there was quite a bit of prior warning, and a lot of the people in charge of the major vacations and tourist industry and things of that nature, it seems like they kind of sat on it for a little while and said, well, we don't want to create a panic here.
Exactly right.
Bad for business. And
now, the Stanford geologist, Kerry C., I've met with him on the San Andreas Fault, and he's one of the pioneers in determining the repeat cycle of a big movement on the San Andreas Fault from his work at Pallet Creek. And he, unbeknownst to me, he had been working 10 years around Sumatra in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And he, at his own expense, had printed up 5,000 brochures about the hazards of a big quake and a tsunami in the Indian Ocean, and he was passing it out to churches and schools, and he had arranged to have a meeting with some of the government leaders on the islands and the countries around the Indian Ocean, and within a couple of weeks of that meeting time, they canceled because they said they didn't have any money for that kind of thing.
Hmm.
So he was on his own, and of course, you were right, they don't want to disturb the economic situation. They don't want tourists to be fleeing the area, and they thought it was just better not to even talk about it. And this is criminal, and this is what I find time and time again with quakes, the big one in Turkey in 1999. They certainly should have known that the North Anatolian Fault had a whole series of large quakes, extremely deadly quakes occurring from eastern Turkey along the North Anatolian Fault and just stepping westward and westward one step at a time and these overlapping disastrous quakes since 1939 and poised under the next area west was Izmit, Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And on August 11th of 1999, a total eclipse of the sun passed over the Atlantic or southern England, France, and over Turkey and ended up in the Indian Ocean. And I warned people that Turkey and India were definitely under the gun. At that time, I did not know about that progression of big quakes going across the North Anatolian Fault. But this country of Turkey knew, and the U.S. Geological Survey knew, and they certainly had a responsibility to pass that along. Not absolutely saying we're 100% sure this is going to happen, but be on the alert. And so that quake occurred 6 days after the eclipse of the sun passed over Turkey. Last year, we had an annular eclipse of the sun on the 3rd of, what was it, October? And on the 7th of October, there was a huge quake in Pakistan. And it, in fact, that's where, that was in the, it wasn't in the path of the center of the annular eclipse, but it was, you could see part of the eclipse in Pakistan. And only 3 or 4 days later is when they had the major quake, like a 7.6, and it killed about 80,000 Pakistani. So how can people keep ignoring these coincidences?
I've just never been, it's never ceased to amaze me, the greed, how much it overshadows human life. If there's enough money involved, you know, people are going to just, it seems like everybody has their price, or every corporation or agency or has their price. And if there's enough money, you know, people are going to go away, and that's just the way it is.
Well, a classic example is the most important discovery I've ever made in my whole experience as a geologist. I've been a geologist since 1948. After completing my bachelor's at Berkeley, and then I went on for my master's at San Jose State, and then mm-hmm. 3 years at working on the doctorate at Cal Davis. But at that time, I didn't know, that earthquake could be predicted, and I was kind of unaware of how much science is held down by politics and economics.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really supported, and it's whatever sounds logical at the time, and it might get a few more votes, seems to be the process.
Go ahead. I have a question. What I've seen, it's very interesting. I've seen there are, especially these new children coming in, that and now there's physics to back this up. They said there's really no reason why we can't know of the future as well as the past, because everything's happening, you know, in the present moment. And all this new quantum physics is pointing to this, and there's these kids that, these seers and other people that have these visions and are seeing these things and, you know, happening ahead of time. And at the same time, the animals are very, you know, attuned to the earth, and they've got their four little legs right on the ground, and the birds as well. And I noticed that you're using animals a lot as far as the runaway rates and things
absolutely.
of that nature.
Now, just briefly, go into the most important thing discovery ever made was in 1979, because of some incidental articles I read and books I'd encountered, I suddenly realized that we'd been totally lied to about the 1906 earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the books said 300 to 400, maybe 452 people had died in San Francisco. And then I started having eyewitness accounts and reading all the old, going back to see the old newspapers, and every book I could get my hands on, realized there'd been a deliberate governmental cover-up within 4 days of that quake. They were starting to say there were 5 or 10,000 killed, it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly Teddy Roosevelt and the cabinet and the Governor Pardee and Mayor Schmitz and right on down, all of them, police chief in San Francisco said, oh, only 250 killed. The director of the U.S. Mint said, less than 300 killed. General Greeley said, 277 killed. This is so preposterous. There were 40,000 Chinese in Chinatown, 21,000 Chinese refugees,
uh-huh.
only 12 Chinese names on the death list. What happened there?
Oh, it's crazy.
Yes. And so I tried to publish on this when I accumulated all these data, submitted it to the state of California. I thought, they're really going to be impressed with this. They quickly kicked it back to me and told me it was too speculative. They had the official numbers. And I said, oh, do you like the 277 or the 315 or the 452 or the 478 or the 498? All sounds very precise, but all a bunch of baloney. There were more than 10,000, and several eyewitnesses at the time believed that very thing. And the evidence was there, and each of the governmental leaders that followed through with this lie advanced rapidly in their careers.
That's the way it goes. It's
yeah.
Amazing.
So anyway, so here we are back with my discovery of seismic windows. And I thought I was the only one that ever had such a concept, and I kind of kept it under wraps while I was just gathering data quietly. And then in 1976, the San Jose State University prevailed upon me. They said, Jim, have you got anything kind of stimulating and controversial? We can't attract the media to this important meeting for our alumni association or giving out these scholarships. And media are totally disinterested, and all they can be interested in right now is that there are discovered pornographic movies being shot on campus, and they can't get enough of that. But here there's, you know, valuable students and worthwhile projects. They don't want to cover that. I said, well, I have something along that line. It's really not ready for publication, but okay, I'll come and I'll give them an earthquake prediction. When I got to this meeting, there were about 100 people in there, 10 reporters with their notebooks poised, and 4 television cameras. And I gave up a fairly reasoned paper. In fact, the geologist there said it was one of the top 3 talks he had heard. I pointed out the importance of ruling theory, that it guides most practices in any field you're in. There are certain precepts that you're considered as factual, and you're mostly expected to adhere to them. If your own information is at variance, it must be something wrong with you or your information, you know. And I'm saying, hey, don't be afraid of the ruling theory. Don't be afraid to test it. Maybe you are onto something new, but then again, maybe you're not, so be cautious. So I talked about my theory, which I'd been at for 2 years, and said there's an extremely good seismic window opening up next week, and I'm expecting a major quake around the world somewhere and a local quake of about 3.5 to 5.5 magnitude. Well, the next day the paper said, major quake to hit county, says geologist. Well, that's not what I said. That's a 7 magnitude quake. I said it would happen somewhere around the world and probably around the Ring of Fire around the Pacific where most of them occur, most of the big ones. But they chose to sensationalize and said it was going to hit the county. Of course, it was entirely wrong. And so I got kind of the horse laugh from most of the people. And then I said, call me back in October, because on October 23rd, there'll be an eclipse of the moon, and even more likely time than here in April. And so one reporter remembered, and it appeared in the Mercury News on the weather forecast page. The title was Prime Time for Quakes Coming Up. Birkeland's last prediction was a dud, but he's trying again. On that day, we got 2 quakes of 3.8 and 3.5, which I had predicted. And it was the day of the eclipse of the moon. And armed with that information, the reporter went to the USGS, and they came back with a volley of negative comments. Birkeland's merely random, matching 2 random series of events. It's a little better than reading tea leaves. You know, if it were this simple, we'd have thought of it long before this and that sort of thing. Birkeland's not a scientist. He's an enthusiast. Well, I'm a fellow in the Geological Society of America, and I've published more than 50 papers, and I'm listed in lots of who's who's, and including who's who in America. And so I am a scientist, but I've found that a scientific fact is at best a progress report subject to change with some new data or some new insight, and that's happened throughout my career.
I've seen
absolute solid precepts change, you know. In 1948-49, when I had my first geology courses, I was told continental drift was absolutely laughable. This German Wegener, Alfred Wegener, well, there's no proof of it. There's no mechanism that can allow the surface of the Earth to move over the mantle. Well, that was the case until 1969, when a whole group of scientists from around the world got together at Pacific Grove near Monterey and compared notes for a week, and that's when plate tectonics was born, and subduction, and all these concepts that now we accept as real. So things change, and I have no doubt that they're going to have to come around and accept that, yes, indeed, the tidal effects from the sun and moon do trigger quakes. Heck, when the astronauts left seismographs on the moon back in 69, and up until about 1974, they put about 3 sets of seismographs up there. They established without any question that moonquakes occur, and almost all of them occur at the time of perigee, once a month, when the Earth and Moon are closest. So the Earth's gravity is triggering moonquakes. And all I'm asking is, can't the Moon's gravity trigger earthquakes?
It's pretty common sense.
Yeah. Well, that was laughed at totally, and they said, come on, Jim, the Moon is only 1/81st the mass of the Earth, and so it's easy to see how the Earth could trigger moonquakes, but not the other way around. I said, come on, the Moon is dead. It doesn't have a liquid core, doesn't have active volcanoes, doesn't have moving plates. The Earth has all those. The Earth is like a living body. The Moon is dead. And I said, you know, if you had a, oh, say a 12-month-old baby on a cot, inside him was this 95-year man, and they all had bare feet sticking out, and you pick a couple of feathers up and tickle the soles of their feet, where are you going to see the reaction? The young body, the active body, which is the Earth.
I like saying they said a fact is only a theory, enough people have agreed upon.
Yeah. And then in 1991, we had the Landers quake down in the desert 2 days before the eclipse of the sun. On the 28th of June, 1991, it was about a 7.5 quake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened then shook up the high science geologists in more ways than one, because within 2 hours, that 7.6 triggered a 6.8 about 40 miles away at Big Bear, mm-hmm. So triggered a series, a swarm of small quakes at Mammoth Lakes, a couple hundred miles north, and then further north up in Lassen, around Mount Lassen Peak, and over in Yellowstone. And within a few days, there was a 5.2 over in western Utah, and then the next day or so, there was a 5.5 down at Yucca Mountain in southern Nevada, where they were planning, you know, to have our nuclear depository site, the waste site.
Mm-hmm.
And we were assured there would never be a 5-magnitude quake within 50 miles of there, and here it happened. It was triggered by the Landers quake. Well, then the spokesman for the U.S. Geological Survey said, we were quite surprised that earthquake could trigger small quakes at Mammoth Lakes, because the amount of energy passing through Mammoth Lakes from that earthquake was less than the energy from the full moon passing overhead. Wonderful, because I don't need less than the full moon. I'll take the full moon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're coming around. They're coming around to the fact that introducing fluids at depth, and that large reservoirs can trigger earthquakes locally. And in Denver in the 1960s, there were more than 900 earthquakes developed around Denver, which had been almost completely aseismic, following their beginning to pump chemical warfare waste down into 12,000-foot wells near Denver. All of a sudden, Denver shook with these 900 quakes over the next 5 years, and some of them were more than 5-magnitude and were damaging. A lone voice out in Denver, David Evans, an engineering geologist, he said, you know, I think Denver quakes are due to pumping that water out there. The U.S. Geological Survey said, come on, that's ridiculous. That's like saying we could raise the Rockies with an eyedropper. We're just letting a little water go down a hole. Well, then they had to shut the pumps off after a few months for maintenance, and then the earthquake stopped.
Hmm.
And after a week or so, the pumps were ready to go again. They started them up, and within a couple of days lag time, the quakes began again. And then the high scientists said, we thought so all the time. It's perfectly logical. Increase the pore pressure, and that allows the faults to slip. So little by little, the word's getting out.
What do you think about L.A.? that whole area there, they've pulled all the oil out, and then they're pumping seawater back into it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, if they could keep it balanced, it wouldn't be so bad. But what happened in Long Beach, they were sucking out all the oil without replacing it, and the harbor settled about 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Long Beach as a 3-year-old, just before I turned 3, where we lived there. And then my parents took us back to Iowa for a few months to show me off to the relatives back there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Long Beach quake hit.
Oh, yeah.
It hit on the day of the eclipse of the moon, on March the 10th, 1933. And the next strong quake in the Los Angeles area was 1971 with the San Fernando quake on February 9th. Guess what? That was the day of the eclipse of the moon.
Mm-hmm. When was that Long Beach quake again?
March 10th, 1933.
Okay.
And so I came back to Glendale. Interestingly, when I was born on July 31st, 1930, My mother from Iowa had never felt an earthquake, of course, and we were in a little cottage there. And she was nursing me a month later, and it was quite a seismic window, as I go back and research. And a 5.2 quake hit in Santa Monica Bay and shook the Glendale rather strongly. And she went running out of the cottage with me at her breast, and she suddenly noticed that the neighbors were staring at her, and she realized that she was a little bit uncovered. And she said, I rushed back inside faster than I came out. But I told that story for the first time when I was invited to speak to the University of Oklahoma. And, of course, they enjoyed that like you did. And it looks like my mother had the last laugh, because a little suburb of Oklahoma, the University of Oklahoma is at, what is that town it's in? Anyway, there's a suburb around 20 miles away called Gertrude, and they had a 4.2 quake a week after I gave my talk. And that's my mother's name, is Gertrude. Mm-hmm. So my son's name is J. Olin Berkland. I wanted initials J-O-B like my dad had, and I've enjoyed having, so I can have J-O-B as my initials and call myself Job. And my wife and I had a bit of a disagreement as to what his middle name would be. Now, with my Norwegian heritage, would have been appropriate maybe for Olaf, Odin, something like that, but she didn't go for that. So then we settled on Olin, O-L-I-N. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, I was looking at an archaeology book about Jose Arguelles,
yeah,
describing the big Aztec calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And in the center of this most highly prized possession for the Mexico Museum, this was cast off the Aztec pyramid by Cortez. And they found it later buried when they were excavating for, a sewer line. And so they brought it up, this big stone circular calendar. In the center is this bloodthirsty god, Tonatio, with a big, long, bloody tongue sticking out.
Mm-hmm.
Circled around him are the four lesser gods, the god of Otl, the god of the seas, Atlantic, Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And next is the god of volcanoes or fire, and the god of the hurricane. But the second most important god was the god of the earthquake. And what was his name? Olin. O-L-I-N. And I didn't know that 10 years earlier.
That's
Jay was born on October 3rd, 1974, the day of the big quake down in Inca land.
Yeah, we have all the same. J-A-G, our initials. Our whole family, there's four of us, and we all have the same initials. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, you can plan it that way.
You know, the Mayan calendar, I think that the calendar is so fascinating.
Mm, quite.
If you take
and everything happening. 2012, and like the new moon, was it December 21st?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. And now we're here that the next sunspot peak is going to be at that time.
Yeah.
And something else I discovered, haven't heard anybody else talk about it. We always say, when's the next big one going to hit the Bay Area? Well, it turns out we had a Loma Prieta quake in 1865 of about 7 magnitude, centered on the same part of the San Andreas where the 1989 World Series quake hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused severe damage in Santa Cruz, in San Jose, on field ground in San Francisco, blocked the highway between Santa Cruz and San Jose, damaged the San Jose hospital and jail. So it was a pretty good jolt.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark Twain really wrote about it. It was a pretty big part of his early career.
Mm-hmm.
What an impression for him, because he was in San Francisco when it hit. Well, that was 1865, and it happened on October 8th, 4 days after the October full moon, and 4 days after the closest approach of the moon for the several years. And the two events were only 7 hours apart.
Amazing.
And, of course, the tides were really high. Well, when the World Series quake hit on October 17th of 1989, there were almost identical astronomical conditions. Here it was on the 14th of October, where the closest approach of the moon in 3 years, the October full moon, and they were only 4 hours apart, and extremely high tides, and that's when You know, 4 days later, we got the Lombard Parietta quake or the World Series quake.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had a 1865, the first Lombard Parietta quake. It took 41 years for the great earthquake to hit San Francisco. 1989 had 41 years to it, and you come up with 2030.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think I'm going to be around to experience the next great earthquake in the San Francisco Bay Area.
I don't know. I think there's some hole cards being played out that are kind of quickening things.
But there could be. I think they're going to be lesser. You know, not a lot, several sixes, and then maybe a seven or two.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. The we talked earlier about that. The World Series quake. I know that you predicted it and went
yes.
on air in several places. And you know, I had the same experience. I had a vision about it, and I was given the exact time and the location and the magnitude, which was 6.9. And we talked about that. They changed it later to 7.1, but a lot of the
No, something it's still called 6.9 on some reports. That's,
okay.
Mm-hmm, that's Berkeley.
And I, you know, I know exactly what you're going up against because when I was in Santa Cruz, when I lived there, I told so many people. I told the Unity Church. I told the minister there. I told so many people this quake was going to hit. And, you know, they basically ran me out of town. They were very upset. It was threatening their lifestyle. And
what about after it hit?
And well, what this is now, this is the funny thing. So I left. I mean, I left and I went to build this center up here in Washington. And the funny thing about it is when I went back there, they were still mad at me.
Well, see what happened to me.
Yeah.
I predicted it, and they wanted me fired.
Exactly. So I totally understand where you're coming from. And they were saying, you know, this guy's nuts. He's crazy. You know, you're creating fear. You're generating this thing through fear. And you might as well just leave town because you're creating it. And I said, well, thank you for all the power you're giving me. But I said, I don't think I'm that powerful that I can set a big quake into motion.
Yeah, kill the messenger.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And you know, and so I kind of, after that experience and about three more, I decided to keep quiet. You know, I'm not going
to. Well, they're never going to silence me. I had to decide early on, was I going to conform? Or was I going to continue to inform? And I said, I don't care. They got knocked off committees and lost a lot of, you know, I couldn't publish anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of other things. But I think it's more important to get the word out to the public. Let them decide what to do with it. And I have to recognize that what I see, what I hear, what I do is more important than what somebody tells me.
Exactly.
Or what I read in a book.
Yeah, I just backed off a little while. I was trying to figure it out. I said, you know, this makes no sense whatsoever. You'd think they'd be a little humble, you know, when you went back and say, hey, you see anything else coming in the future?
No, in fact,
it was the opposite.
If you look at the latest glossy publication from the U.S. Geological Survey that we just got in our newspapers about 3 days ago, it's about a 20-page, beautiful reproduction of various aspects of the 1906. And discussing earthquake preparedness and all these different features about the Cascadia subduction zone,
mm-hmm.
you name it. I carefully went through this whole glossy production. There's not one single mention of the word predict or forecast.
Oh,
they
yeah.
deliberately avoided the whole topic because they're unable to do it.
Well, speaking of that Cascadia, it has been getting pretty active. And
yes, that is definitely a hot risk.
Yeah, that last one, I kind of saw that one. I was down there working in the area.
The Nisqually quake in 2001?
What's that?
The Nisqually quake in 2001?
That recent one we just had off the coast of Oregon.
Oh, yes, okay.
Along that range.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, it's my gut feeling when I was down there. I could feel real strongly that, you know, I'm one of those people that has those strange dreams that seem
yeah.
to come true a lot. And, you know, I've had some dreams about San Francisco area getting hit again, you know, this summer around June. You know, I don't know exactly when, because when I see the visions, it's very hard to put a time to it. But I also saw the Cascadia range there just busting loose around September. And I think you were saying that was a prime time for,
yes.
for an event.
Again, it's a coming.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of interesting, you know, if we take, you know, I believe like you in a way, I think we need to take all the data,
sure,
put it in a line, and start tossing out the stuff that doesn't fit, and the things that are hitting, you know, take it all the way through to the dreams, you know, to the animal runaways, to everything. Just
magnetic field, gravity field, strain gauges, tilt meters.
Exactly.
And, you know, whales beaching themselves, homing pigeons getting lost, animals running away.
Yeah, astrological, everything. Just put it right down the line and say, okay, here's this point. Everything is aiming at this event to happen and see what happens. You know, it's amazing that we don't use all the data available and how it's tapped.
There are many, many pieces of the puzzle, and just overlook an important piece is ridiculous.
Man, it's amazing. Until it hits somebody on the head, it doesn't exist, you know.
Sure.
You know,
Well, in January of 1989, I looked ahead and I saw October 14th to 21st was a classic seismic window. So in my top window list that I sent out to all my subscribers, that was listed as an 80% chance for a 3.5 to 5.5 magnitude quake to occur within 2 degrees of San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was 1 degree of San Jose because I was still down there. When I moved up here to the wine country, I extended it 2 degrees because I want to share in my own predictions. But and that's 140 miles, a 2 degree circle. And then as we got into September, the middle of September, suddenly all the animals began to run away in record numbers. Now, I usually saw in the lost and found column two or three missing cat ants. There were 27. Mm-hmm. I mean, watching this for 10 years at that point, that was terribly impressive. So I thought there was going to be a quake in late September. The missing dogs, meanwhile, instead of being 20 ads, there were 57. And there was no quake in late September. And then I read about the Chinese experience where they found before larger earthquakes, there's a longer advance warning from what the animals do. And it affects a larger area. Now, it's perfectly logical. So I said, well, and I guess maybe it'll be in October, but the numbers dropped from where they had been dramatically and went down to lower numbers again. And then suddenly they surged back up, and on the 13th of October, the dog ads were even higher. There were 58, and the cat ads went back up to, I think, 16, which was still very high. And so at that point, not only did we have all these missing animals again and the highest tidal force in 3 years, but we had extremely rare whales that just beached themselves at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, beaked whales, only 9 feet long, little baby ones, alive, and took them over to Marine World. And while they're caring for them in Marine World, an equally rare pygmy sperm whale washed up at Santa Cruz Beach within 5 miles of the upcoming epicenter.
Mm-hmm.
So they were taking care of him down in Monterey Aquarium. Meanwhile, the champion homing pigeon flew the coop, didn't come back for a week after the quake.
Yeah.
And we had waterfalls that began to flow much more rapidly, and we had two hot springs slowing down and cooling down. And we had some sensitive people saying, oh, this looks really bad, and shortly I think there's going to be a big quake. And Time Research Institute, the president there is Marcia Adams, and she was getting sensitive people from across the country calling her. And I called her on Sunday before the Tuesday quake and said, we're due for a 6.5 to 7 here in the next few days. She said, I agree with you. I'm getting all these calls. We have this big ionosphere glitch. I have a downlink with a satellite. So magnetic field is changing. And I'm looking out on my patio up here in Woodside, and there's a whole herd of deer standing out looking back at me. That's never happened before. So 2 days later, we got the quake right on schedule. I've cataloged some 20 different clues that quake was coming. And that's why I gave it an 85% chance. I've upgraded my magnitude to a 6.5 to 7. And I was pleased that one gal saw my prediction and said, Jim, are you really serious about this? And I said, yes. Should I take down my crystal and china collection? I said, if you've ever seriously considered it before, now is the time. And she did. And when her china cabinet toppled over, on October 17th, all of her precious china and crystal were packed in boxes. She said, I saved $6,000 worth. Thank you, Jim. Yeah,
that's great. You know, not to mention just the monetary value, but just to think of the lives that could be saved.
Yes.
You know, by just people listening and, you know, setting their pocketbook aside and start looking at human life as the most precious thing on the planet.
Now, there was an object lesson in 1933. That's the Long Beach quake, day of the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened around 4:45 in the evening. And it was devastating to the school buildings, those masonry, unreinforced masonry school buildings in Long Beach and that area. And the governor quickly appointed a committee to look into the damage and see how bad it was and what they might do to prevent it again. And they came in within 10 days, a frightening report. They said if school had still been in full session, say at 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we would have lost between 10,000 and 30,000 school kids.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine that in a, yeah, in a civilized country?
Uh-huh.
So that's why the state legislature never acted so quickly in its entire existence. They adopted the Field Act, which required additional structural safety for schools, and the governor signed it on March the 31st. The quake was on the 10th. The committee went out there for about a week, came back in, and the legislature got off their duffs and adopted the most important seismic safety legislation in the history of California, maybe the country.
Well, that gives me a little faith, you know, for our government.
Well, those people are long gone. I don't know who's in Sacramento these days. They're all on vacation.
Yeah, they're waiting for the next big one to shake them up a little, probably.
Yeah.
Let me give out the call numbers in case we might have some callers that want to check
in. Hope, yeah.
The call numbers for the radio, if you want to check in and ask some questions, it's 888-268-4313. So if there's any callers out there that want to call in and ask any questions, again, the number is 888-268-4313. Looking forward to your call. Okay, where were we?
Well, I'll tell you that in 1995, that's the first time I really began predicting for the Seattle and Puget Sound area.
Mm-hmm.
I was challenged by a television station, I think it was Como, and it was a town meeting on a Sunday. And they wanted me to appear, they were going to fly me up there, and I said, but I'm flying down to Los Angeles to be on the other side on Friday. But if you want to fly me directly Saturday, directly up to Seattle, I can make it. Well, we'll just interview at home. So I flew home, and I was there waiting for the Sunday call. And when it came in, I was held for about 10 minutes on the open line. And I heard that this meeting was on earthquake preparedness, not prediction. And there were all these Red Cross and OES people and people from the USGS and University of Washington. So when they said, now we have a geologist in San Jose who's going to give us an earthquake prediction, Mr. Berkland, are you there? And I said, yes, and now that I've heard what is going on there, I want you all to know that earthquake preparedness is certainly more important than prediction because they're going to happen whether you predict them or not. So you have to assume that and be ready. Yes, yes, we want your prediction. And I said, well, also, it's more important to really know you're ready. If you think you're ready and you're not, if your flashlight batteries have died out and you have no portable radio and your generator won't start or whatever, that's worse than thinking you're prepared. Knowing you're not prepared is better than thinking you're prepared and not be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, yes, so we want your prediction. So I said, okay, I believe you're going to have a 5-magnitude quake in the Seattle area within a week. And I heard all this chuckling from all these experts in the panel there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, apparently your panel there is unaware of the thousands or the hundreds of articles in the world literature about tides. And click, he hung up on me. And then I got letters from the Seattle area saying that wasn't normal northern hospitality, and we wanted to hear what you had to say. And then I got some letters saying the same thing. And then 6 days later, the 5.0 hit under the Seattle airport. And then I got 2,000 letters from the Puget Sound area.
It would be great to get that clip and to have them all laughing in the background.
Yes, oh my, I would like to hear that again.
Yeah, and then go back on again right after that and just say,
yeah.
I have a clip of our last interview. Let's listen to this piece.
Oh, of course they wouldn't do that.
Exactly.
Now, I was interviewed, I was invited to speak to the Foundation for the Study of Cycles in Irvine, California, back in February of 1990. And I was talking about the similarity of those two quakes, the Loma Prieta quakes of 1865 and 1989, and I called them the twin quakes, and I spoke for about an hour and a half. And it happens that I had gone to lunch with my daughter at UCLA at the time before the meeting, and before my talk, and I looked at the lost and found column of the Los Angeles Times, and there were 58 missing dogs and about 12 missing cats, mm-hmm. which were high numbers. And so instead of this little lost and found column of about 4 inches long, this was about 9 inches long. And I took it out of my vest pocket, unfurled it, and I said, now, I want to save time for questions. I also want to alert you folks to my concern that there's going to be a 5-plus magnitude quake here within 3 days, mm-hmm. because my seismic window opens in 3 days, and all these animals are away. This is close to a record number. It's similar to what you see after the 4th of July, which frightens the animals considerably. And then after, on the 9th and 10th of July, usually you have the high numbers of missing dogs. So it looks like the earthquake, something goes on with the magnetic field about a week to 10 days in advance, and then it shows up in the newspaper after a lag time of 5 or 6 days. So I warned them, and a fellow in the back of the room got up and got out the door, and I never saw him again. 10 days later, I got a call from him. He said, Mr. Berkland, congratulations on another hit. I didn't want to share in it. I checked out of the hotel immediately and took the first plane back to New York. And what happened 3 days later was the Upland quake of 6 magnitude, which did a lot of damage about 30 miles north of Irvine, where I gave the talk. Uh-huh. That talk was tape recorded, videotaped. Mm-hmm. And so there can be no doubt that I made the prediction that it hit.
Well, it'd be great to get these little clips and put them all together and then show.
I've got about 10 of them, yeah.
Yeah, and then show the headlines right afterwards, you know,
mm-hmm.
boom, boom, boom,
yeah.
And then go.
Time after time.
Yeah, I had to go back and play it for all your ex-buddies.
Yeah.
Back
well,
there.
I had a group from BBC come here in 1998 to my home in San Jose, and we talked, you know, for half an hour, and then they said, well, can you give us a specific prediction for our British audience? And I said, well, I'm looking at all these missing animals down now in the lost and found column of San Jose and Mercury, and also in San Francisco, high number. So I believe there's going to be a 4.5 or better magnitude quake in the Bay Area here within 3 days because my window closes in 3 days. And so they said, thank you, and they folded up their cameras and headed back to San Francisco where they're going to fly to Japan the next day. That night, the 5.5 hit south of them and shook them in their motel, and they were pretty impressed with that.
Yeah, they've got they just had 2 pretty good-sized quakes, I think, in Japan, and then 1 in Chile.
Yeah.
Just
well, we have not had a major quake, though, since the 24th of February, and that one was in a very unlikely place in southern Africa, in Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found that that's really the southern extension of the East African Rift Zone.
Yeah, it's kind of split in that country in half,
yes,
it looks like.
Yes, yes. It's going
looks
to
like
be,
there'll be an ocean there pretty soon.
The Red Sea, and then eventually a new Atlantic, yeah.
You know, I was wondering, it does seem to be, what I've watched over and over, we have these massive solar flares. And then all that energy's got to be absorbed, you know, it seems like, somehow.
Well, I've kind of poo-pooed that for years, and then about 3 years ago, I got a list of the 21 largest flares of X9 to X21.
Mm-hmm.
From like 1977 to 1990 or something like that. Well, what did I see? There was an X13 on the day of the 2 days after the Loma Prieta quake. On exactly the day of the 7.4 quake at Eureka, on exactly the day of the 6.2 quake, the Morgan Hill quake down in our area. And there were about 3/4 of them I could match up with a quake.
Yeah, it's amazing.
A very unusual quake. So I'm saying now, even though I don't understand the mechanism, there does seem to be a causal relationship.
Yeah, there seems to be this vibrational continuum that these subtle energies or real high-frequency energies are moving through, and it's affecting human consciousness, it's affecting the weather, it's affecting
satellites,
the Earth,
radio,
everything.
Yes, the whole thing, and the human behavior.
You know, they did a study at Stanford. They did some research on monkeys, and they exposed these monkeys to fluctuations in the magnetic fields, and they exhibited behavior, everything from comatose to self-mutilation.
Really?
You know, so you can imagine what these strong fluctuations are doing, both with the earthquake.
What's going on up with HARP. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you add HARP to that and whatever else they're playing with,
mm-hmm.
you know, who knows.
Well, we just have to keep our eyes and minds open. and not believe all that we read in the papers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I think to get the truth nowadays, you have to go outside the box. It's just,
absolutely.
The box is just closed down right now.
You may have seen the false reports that came out from Yucca Mountain. They had the scientific reports, which they changed the data in because it was not good for the nuclear depository site.
Oh, yeah.
And it was fraud. And we see our fellow with the DNA in Korea. What was that he was doing there?
Cloning or?
It just, that's the worst possible crime against humanity is to defraud us.
Yeah.
Tell us the truth and give us the data that you have and give us the probabilities. You know, I don't expect everybody to know everything. But when somebody, a meteorologist says, hey, we've got this this cold air coming down off of the over the Gulf warm air, and it's creating a vertical wind shear, and we might have thunderstorms and maybe even tornado. I want to know about that.
Oh, exactly. You know, another thing is with the, you know, we talked a little bit about these chemtrails.
Yes.
It's amazing here as we watch these blue skies just turn into this crisscross gray with these big shark tooth or sawtooth.
Yeah, pinkish sunsets.
Yeah, and you know, and then everybody starts getting sick and upper respiratory
problems. Oh man, and runny noses and.
Oh, it's a mess, and you cannot get anybody to talk about that. I mean,
that's right.
Went to senators, we went to everybody. I went on Channel 11 and brought all of these top people. You know, the EPA spilled the beans on it, the FAA, all these people were spilling the beans on this thing, but they will not touch it.
It's
unbelievable.
It's really something, yes.
And, you know, and people think about, well, you know, freedom of press. Hey, we have freedom of press. You know, I think about down in Mexico, you've got hundreds and hundreds of UFOs flying almost on a regular basis. It's well documented. They're filming it.
Have we
heard about it here?
I've seen the video, yeah.
Yeah, and then you've got all these free energy devices coming out that are phenomenal, you know, with incredible output on them, but, you know, these guys just disappear, and you cannot get it on media. They will not touch it.
Do you have any callers out there at all? Where are all the people there? They must be listening to something.
You know, I don't know if we've, I know there's a little hardware problem there at the station right now. We're getting fixed as far as our call-in line. I hope it's working.
Hello?
The last show we had a problem with that line, so... you know, I guess we'll just continue and keep it on going unless we do it.
We have the next window opening up between the 26th and the 2nd of May, and that's based on the next new moon, and it's fairly close to perigee.
Okay.
And the tides will be over 7 feet. And it happens that in the Bay Area, our biggest earthquake months are March, April, and October. We've had half of our damaging earthquakes in those 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you would really, you know, expect no more than one quarter of them in four months, in 3 months.
Well, I heard some strange noise there. Do we have a caller?
Oh, actually, sorry, folks. We did have a caller, but I knew that we have Sherry Edwards' show coming up.
Okay.
And since the caller called so late... Had the call a little earlier, we'd have put her on the air, but...
we don't know what the question was.
No, we don't. And we have Sherry Edwards coming on here in about a minute.
Okay, well, this fun, been fun.
Okay, yeah, I guess we'll have to wrap it up here pretty quick. So you think you got a major window May 7th?
No, it's April 26th.
Oh, April 26th.
May 2nd.
May 2nd. And that's when we've got the high tides. It only makes sense, you know, you got that massive amount of water moving up over the land. It's got to be putting some pressure on those plates.
A foot of water is nearly 1 million tons per square mile.
Uh-huh.
And also a low pressure cell, a 1 inch of mercury is 13.6 inches of water, so that's more than a foot of water if you had an inch change in air pressure.
Oh, yeah, water's heavy. You know, it's amazing that... that people can't put, I mean, that's a no-brainer there.
Yes. Well, one of the leading geologists ever was the president of the American Association for Advancement of Science, and in his presidential address, G.K. Gilbert said in 1909, In southeastern Alaska, where the faults are parallel to the coast, the tides are sufficient to trigger earthquakes. Mm-hmm. He did not equivocate.
Yeah, it's just beyond me that it isn't really beyond me, because I've seen this over and over again, is that people fear the unknown and change. You know, they fear those more than anything else. They really don't want to know what's coming in the future, and they don't want to change.
Well, some people do, and that's why I have about 350 subscribers to my newsletter.
Great.
Yeah.
Now, what's your website there? Can you give that out?
Sure, absolutely. SYZYGYJOB.com. Syzygy Job. SYZYGYJOB. And, of course, syzygy means aligning up with the sun, moon, and earth.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my new book is out about me. It's called The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, Jim Berkland, Maverick Geologist, written by Cal Ori, a gal that's been interested in what I've been doing for about 20 years and finally put together pretty much a story of my life and times.
Great. And that's available through the website?
Oh, no, anywhere. It's
in
all bookstores.
Barnes & Noble.
You get it for like $16.95, yeah. Barnes & Noble is where we're going for the book signings. We'll be down in Fisherman's Wharf and on the 18th. Mm-hmm. And then on the 19th, we're going to San Bruno, Barnes & Noble, and then over to Walnut Creek. And I've already done Santa Rosa, Reno, San Jose, Gilroy, Lake Tahoe. So we're getting the word out, and that pretty much describes what I've been doing now since 1974. And it
well,
has
we'll
lived in my
that
life before that
up
also.
On the website here for the radio station. And what's nice is this is all going to be archived, and so we'll also have your information there that
right.
people can listen to any time. And when these other events bust loose, you can say, hey, I said it.
Okay, now, Southern California is due for a 6-plus magnitude quake this year, because the history has been, after extremely heavy rainfall years, most of their 6 magnitude quakes have occurred. And they had a drought year 3 years ago, and the record rainfall last year, well, within just a couple of tenths of the all-time record.
Mm-hmm.
So they expect a 6 magnitude quake this year.
Oh, they're definitely due for it, especially with the rain they've been getting.
Yeah.
You know, they're starting to evacuate people out of the San Joaquin Valley and areas like that.
Yeah, right. that snowpack may get a warm rain, and it'll really be flooding problems.
Well, I guess we're going to have to wrap it up here. So,
good.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and keep up the great work. I've always been fascinated by your work, and I really hope you'll keep on these guys. You know,
oh, yes. As long as I last, I'm certainly going to be pecking away there.
Sounds awesome. Well, thank you so much
for
coming on the show.
Right. Bye.
And this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, and we'll be signing off. Have a great evening.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.